Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.
State of Hawaii, we eat more spam than anywhere else in the country. And my wife hates it when I do this. We have someone that invites us over to something, and they go, bring Hawaiian food. And I bring the Hawaiian version of PB&J, which is a spam musubi. That is a block of rice with fried spam on it wrapped in nori.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Fell into Food Podcast. I am your host, Chef Jeff Fell. Joining me today is Rob Maddock. And I'm excited to jump into this. We started chatting a little bit on LinkedIn. We finally met at NAFM. But, you know, one, how's your day? And then two, we're going to dive right into Hawaii.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, in contrast to Hawaii, I'm sitting here on a very snowy day in Denver. So my day is going well otherwise.
Yeah. So, you know, looking at your background, I think I want to really start with what food was like growing up in Hawaii. I know it's a very family culture type there and how that really impacted you. So maybe let's start, you know, from the beginning and how you fell into food, but more so how the food from Hawaii impacted you.
Yeah. So, I mean, Hawaii is really all about family. I think next to maybe being born into the family I was born into and having the parents I had, meeting my wife, the luckiest thing that ever happened to me was being born in Hawaii. I mean, I had the picture perfect childhood. And, you know, our idea of Friday, Saturday night is normally someone's backyard, someone's garage, and a lot of food. And it's funny because my wife's from Pittsburgh. And when you eat food at dinner table, it's like we're eating German food tonight and we're eating Chinese food, whatever have you. And in Hawaii, with the culture, it's really a mixture. So at one table, you'd sit down, you'd probably have kimchi alongside kalua pig, alongside, I don't know, mashed potatoes or even more so rice. But right. So it was a really great place to grow up. And it certainly was. My family loved food. And so we cooked a lot together. And that still influences me today. If I feel homesick, I tend to be cooking, stir fried rice or something like that as a comfort food and not as an Irishman, Irish food.
Nice. Yeah, I actually just did a stir fried rice. It's just so good, so easy, so quick earlier today. You know, but what was there a particular moment, right, growing up in that culture and that really shaped or formed you wanting to get into food?
Yeah, you know, actually, funny enough, it wasn't necessarily in Hawaii. When I was 14, I went to boarding school. It was a decision. It wasn't like a correctional institution. It was a decision we made. I have dyslexia. And at that time, we thought the best help would be in Boston. And so I moved at 14 and I went to boarding school. And it was a tough experience. It was a very different culture. And I found refuge in the kitchen. And, it started basically falling in love with the people that work in kitchens and kitchen culture that I still hold on to today. And I was able to cook in that kitchen. And that left me down a road where I made food my profession. And I cooked professionally for about 20 years after that before getting into factory work.
Yeah, which is really interesting. Again, the more people I talk to in the industry, it's that they went chef route or that cooking culture and then jumped into something else, a side branch. And now again, going equipment, and we'll dig back into the background, but maybe just a quick touch on, you know, you're at Tux now, which again, a lot of people, it's probably like an unheard of name, but probably something you've eaten has came from one of your systems, to be completely honest. So maybe just a quick overview of who Tux is, and then we'll kind of intertwine the two.
Yeah, sure. So Tux, we're an American manufacturer. We make everything out of Princeton, Minnesota, which is like an hour north of Minneapolis. And when I say we make it, I mean, we bend steel and weld and all that sort of fun stuff. Not me. I'm too gentle in this world, but, the guys who are stronger, tougher dudes than I am do. And, what we do is we basically make, cooking at scale, something that's very easily attainable. And it allows for really high consistency and really great products.
Yeah. So maybe just, I know cook chill is a big piece of it. Maybe just, I know there's three major categories. Again, just to give people context, they hear cooking systems, but I don't think they really understand the sheer volume and what that actually means.
Yeah, no. And I think, we kind of straddle what we call food service or traditional like restaurants and that sort of thing and process. And we're kind of in between. So sometimes that terminology gets a little funky, right? The chef in me gets really nervous when someone starts talking about particulates in food. That's the business. When you're talking about cook chill, the first thing I always like to bring up is, it's classic technique at the end of the day. When we cook professionally and when we cook in restaurants, we're doing things like blanching asparagus so that we can get that really great product when we go to grill it or we put those marks on it. We're making soups normally ahead of day. We're not making soups to order. That'd be crazy. I remember like for a while when Iron Chef was a really big thing and my friends knew I was a chef and they go, well, is that real? I'm like, well, I don't think there's a humanly possible way to braise a lamb shank in 30 minutes. Prep and cook chill is something we do, right? So we cook it, we chill it down. Yeah. What makes the difference between it being good and being something we can be proud of really comes down into how well we do it, just like anything else in the kitchen. And so having the right equipment allows you to do that. When I started my career, I was working with combis, my second career, pardon me. I was working with combis and blast chillers. And I think that's kind of that's the first line of cook chill and sous vide, right? Is you're going to go ahead and we're going to cook it. We're going to chill it down. And we're going to do it really, really well. And then we're going to bring it back up. And maybe when we bring it back up, that's when that Maillard reaction is going to happen. Maybe that's just heating it through, whatever that looks like. So we take that level, and that's a good level that can be applied in any kitchen. And then we inject steroids into it. And so we build kettles that can fit 50 to 800 gallons of product in it at a time. Give you an idea of that, the average hot tub's 400 gallons. And then we do it well and we cool it down in such a fashion there's not a loss of quality in that process. Something cool that also kind of happens is on that level of cooking, you start doing things like pasteurizing in a bag, which again, that straddling between food service and process is not the sexiest way to refer to something like that. But when we pasteurize in a bag and when we cook things in a bag, it increases its shelf life to 28 or 30 days. And again, without adding additives, without adding extraneous items, it's really dramatic. And I think when you bring it back into, obviously there's things that are right in front of you, your tomato bisque soup, that sort of thing. But I think when you get, look at the application of it, that could be a scratch made broth that's made and processed in that system that allows your restaurants or your hotels to offer a really high quality product that's consistent, that in the modern kitchen, it's become harder and harder to execute with labor and with logistics.
Yeah, labor is such an issue, and you're seeing a lot more tech and or machinery help support, again, especially as a brand grows and they need that consistency, that quality across the board. You almost have to. It becomes really difficult to do an on-site. I mean, you look at things like Panera, right? They went from bacon house to having their own facility, doing a par bake, and then they finish it. And I know a lot of people are kind of going towards that model because it's just too hard to do those daily operations with the staff that you have, the skill level that you have, and what you guys do allows at a large scale to handle that. Given your background, you went CIA, you went Johnson Wales, so you got the real chops, you went to the schools, but why then pursue an MBA after all of that culinary training?
Yeah. So that was luck and that was ego, to be honest. So I took a position with a company, and the first day I'm in an HR office, as someone who spent 20 years in the kitchen, it was kind of an unusual experience. Normally, my onboarding in the kitchen was so-and-so didn't show up today, who was supposed to train you, get on the line, and you'll figure it out as you go, kind of thing. And, you know, they're going through the benefits. And I'm also used to a world where they talk about sick days, but you never take a sick day off. You had to be in the kitchen no matter what. And all of a sudden, these guys were like, hey, so this is your education benefit. And I go, what's that? And they go, well, we'll pay you to go back to school. And again, for someone who has never been around that world, it was earth shattering to me that someone would help out on that. And so I enrolled into a program out here in Colorado, and I was lucky enough to be accepted. And it took me about 4 years balancing work and a family, but I was able to get it done.
And what was that degree in?
That's a master's in business.
Master's in business. Yeah. Okay. So when was the turning point, right? You're in kitchens for a long time, right? And what was that sparking moment that said, you know what, I'm going to jump into equipment manufacturing per se, or this branch of the tree?
Yeah, no, I think it's like anything else in your life, or at least in my life, I didn't realize it happened until it happened. So I think, and I know this from friends, the true weight in running in a kitchen, working in a kitchen, I feel like is what happens outside the kitchen. And for me, that was a failed, engagement. And I was thrilled, in recollection, not at the time. At the time, it was pretty earth shattering. And luckily, I'm now married and very, very happy. But a lot of that was due to the stress and that work balance that you have to somehow achieve in what I think is one of the most difficult industries out there. And so not too long after that, I was speaking to a colleague of mine, and they mentioned they needed a traveling chef to help work with kitchens and implement new technology. And I took that on, and I did that for a number of years. And then somehow I ended up in like a sales role, and I'm not totally sure how that happened. But at the end of the day, you know, I think when people talk about sales, they envision like a used car salesman or something like that. Mm-hmm. All I do is I take my culinary knowledge and I speak to people who have been in the position that I have been in the past, some frequently doing it better than I ever did it. And I point out, hey, here are some opportunities to make your life better and to make your day easier. And that might make your day easier in the fact that you get to go home and be around your family. Or that might be better because you know that you're now more profitable. And so you have more room to breathe every month when you cut those checks.
And what would you say kind of the most common thing that those opportunities that you're seeing operators in today's world, there's gotta be some sort of pattern. I would assume that's kind of something is at the top.
You know, I think it's always been people in the business. And like I said earlier, the people in the business is is what makes me miss being in the kitchen and really what I love about my time in the kitchen full time. But I know it's harder and harder to get the people that you want in that kitchen with you, right? It's harder to find them. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly harder to find the money to pay them. I know so many of us who've managed people have employees that we wish we could give them everything in the world because they're crucial to us, but they can't, right? And so by implementing equipment and procedures that allows you to do more with less people, then you can continue to hire the folks that you want and maybe even give those folks better compensation because you don't have to hire 20 people, you're hiring 10 or something of that nature, right? I think the other thing is I think every person that has managed a kitchen suddenly finds himself doing a lot less of the cooking and the stuff that they envisioned their career being, and a lot more of doing the administrative stuff. And that could be hiring, or that could be figuring out how to produce the food you need to do. And with equipment, you can do that. So for instance, we have a lot of customers that are centralizing their production. And so what that allows them to do, because of economies of scale, that allows them to have one or two key employees making a product. And with that automation of muscle that a piece of equipment does, they can now produce more with less employees. And depending on cook chill, it also frequently means you can do it at a time that's not service, right? Like you offset that service time to prep ahead of time and to prep in bulk. So what that then means is, you know, maybe that employee who can't work those Friday and Saturdays, it's a key employee to you, you can still utilize them earlier in the week or in off hours and give them a better quality of life throughout the process. And in turn, those guys who are working that Friday, Saturday night aren't trying to prep on the line for service. You know, economies of scale is such a powerful term. And, you know, basically we're going to make more, and when we make more of something, we increase the consistency and we decrease the costs and the items that come along with that. And a perfect example of this is, like, let's say we need to produce, I don't know, let's say 10, or sorry, let's do 4 of the biggest pot in our kitchen. So we go over to our 6 burner, we throw those tall hats on there, we get them ripping, and we're cooking. And you're there and you're cooking that product. But I guarantee you, if you took those 4 tall hats off and you tasted the product in each single one of them, you're going to find variation. Even though you're the operator, you had the same piece of equipment, you were standing there. Versus if you had one big pot that it all cooked in, you'd find that entire product be really consistent. When that magnifies into, okay, we're going to now try to cook multiple batches over multiple locations, over multiple employees, it's almost impossible to do it consistently, which is we put it all in one space and we're cooking in larger kettles and larger pieces of equipment. Suddenly, consistency becomes very, very easy to achieve.
Yeah, it's there's so many variables in the kitchen, right? People talk about trying to systematize and make it, it is what it is. And they're like, but this is my recipe, and they follow it. And it's like, but just because you follow a recipe doesn't mean it's going to turn out how you cook a recipe and how I cook a recipe. One, there's maybe 2 interpretations, right? Based upon background, skill, training, you know, what a braise to you is to me versus a roast and how long that happens. Again, 2 completely separate things. I always noticed, it kind of goes back to your point of, you know, the higher you go, the less cooking you do. That happened pretty quick. And I had these dreams. I'm like, I'm going to be in the kitchen. I'm going to be cooking all the time. And it didn't take but a couple years. And I was already in an administrative type role. And it was like, oh man, I don't get to cook anymore. So when I got the opportunities, I did. But one time, I will never forget it. In higher education, it was a Sunday. And Sundays were a little slow. Kids were getting back to campus. So it wasn't a big deal. And I had a chance. I went through all the procedures. It was a union environment. So, you know, you had to call people, whatever. And I was like, well, I'm cooking today. And actually, it was kind of one of those like mental releases. I was like, yes, I get to cook and I'm not stuck in an office. And so I made everything. I'm pretty sure it was pork loin, like a barbecue pork loin, nothing crazy, but I just cooked it as you should. And I actually read the recipe and did it to a T because I wanted to make sure that the team couldn't pinpoint me for anything. Like, you didn't follow the recipe. And the feedback was, oh my gosh, why is this taste so good? And I was like, what do you mean? I just followed the recipe. And they're like, no, we had this last month and it didn't taste like this. And then it got me thinking, like, well, just because you have a recipe doesn't mean that the outcome is going to be the same every time because of those variables. So to me, it's almost like what you guys do is you're almost like the AI of the kitchen. You know, if you think about it like that, right?
Absolutely.
AI streamlines and enhances productivity, enhances what people do. Yes. Like you said, it's already hard to find people and be like, well, it's taking jobs. Well, no, you're actually just enhancing what people can do. And to your point, then being able to turn around and pay them better, because now if you can do what 3-4 people did with one guy or gal, well, you can take some of that, you know, benefits, pay, give it to somebody and then give them a better quality of life. That's going to make them want to stay. Like you said, those key people in the kitchen.
Absolutely. No, I think you're spot on it. You know, I still get to cook professionally a little bit. I work with a nonprofit called Nourish Colorado. Yes. And we go into like public schools. We work with the kitchen folk in those public schools and teach them knife skills and that sort of thing and kind of how to improve what their operations are. One of the things we did is we like did a recipe and we had everyone weigh out ingredients or measure out ingredients. And we came back and we weighed them all. And even with everyone doing the same recipe in the same room, the variation of actual ingredients changes wildly in that process. And that's going to change that flavor and it's going to change your food costs dramatically. So yeah, a very good example.
Man, and you segued right into the next thing. I was going to go right into that nonprofit that you work with. you know, one, how long you've been doing it, maybe just a little background on what that program is.
Yeah. So, so it's kind of a funny story. I started off as Live Well Colorado. And for those of you that are not aware of this, the great state of Colorado was the first state to legalize marijuana. And Live Well was also the name of a marijuana dispensary. And since Live Well, the nonprofit I help out, nonprofits tend to not have a lot of money. After about 8 years of the people accidentally calling us looking for cannabis, we sold the name to Live Well, which is a dispensary. And so now it's Nourish Colorado. So, but it's the same organization and same mission. And what we do is we partner with local schools in the state of Colorado. We've done some work outside of Colorado as well, but that's our core. And give them the culinary skills to achieve more cooking from scratch, as well as, you know, guidance and recipe creation and tasting and marketing of food to the students. And it's one of the most rewarding things I get to do on a daily basis.
And how long you been doing that?
Well over a decade.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Let me put it this way.
Crazy long time.
My chef coach started at large, and now it's XL. Well, double XL. How about that? That long ago.
I mean, I'm blessed with the metabolism of the gods, and people look at me and like, I don't trust you. You're a skinny chef. I go, I was just blessed with good genes. Don't blame me. I still eat quite a bit. What are some of the biggest changes? It's been a decade working in those schools. Again, that's the kind of where my background was. So, you know, what are some of the biggest changes you've seen in those schools, helping them produce fresh, quality food, and how the program has evolved over those years?
You know, we're seeing a lot more local food finally working its way into the space. You know, I lived in Napa Valley for a couple of years, and local food in Napa Valley is really easy. Because you have like all this product all year long, right? In the state of Colorado and like in Illinois, it gets more and more complicated because now, you know, we have a growing season that really ends in October, and now we're moving into beets and potatoes until we get back into spring. But there's been an increased interest in bringing in local product. I think the students that are coming through school now are more willing to try things than they were willing to try 10 years ago. And that's opened a lot of doors into really some really beautiful dishes and getting some food out to the students that they deserve.
That's super cool. Hands-on working again. Yeah, that local farm to table type movement. I know there's been some programs, which I know Illinois, they reinstated the, I think it's the LFS program. I don't know if Colorado's on the NSLP program or they can pick and choose what programs they're on, but you know, there was all these funds for schools to be able to access money to be able to provide some of that local, which can be challenging, right? It can be higher because usually it's smaller producers, smaller growers, and their operational costs are higher. And, you know, at the end of the day, they still have a family to feed and take care of. So it can be difficult. You know, what are some measures that you've done maybe with working with these schools to help implement those programs to even help offset some of those costs?
Yeah. So, you know, I think this kind of bridges both worlds that I'm in right now. So both on the equipment side and in the school side, basically a school gets a certain amount of money from the federal government that allows them to buy product. And what normally happens is if it's called brown box, and what normally happens is they will deviate raw proteins, which means they'll send it to a company like Tyson. Tyson will cook and bread and send it back to them. Or any product like that, a prepared product at a cost. A lot of the districts we work with are very small, and they're, you know, in isolated areas of Colorado. What that means is we've now sent that money outside of that district, right? And we've sent that job outside of the district, and jobs are very much needed in a lot of these communities. So by cooking in-house, we are providing, you know, we're keeping that money in the district. The district gets to use it for not only other uses within the schools, but it also provides a job for folks. And, you know, yeah, just wonderful people in the kitchen. And it's kind of funny that I started in a school cafeteria, basically as a dishwasher. And I still find myself in a school cafeteria as a chef consultant. So it's the way the world works, right?
Man, you hit the nail on the head with that one. You are so true. I thought, you know, when I hopped out, I would never go back into a school, and it's the complete opposite. I'm working on a beef project and bringing local food to schools and helping them show the real numbers. It's just, like you said, it's really funny. I want to ask, you know, how can chefs, since we're on the school topic, how do chefs play a role in transforming institutional food?
Yeah, no, I think, so I think one of the first things that we're allowed to touch in the kitchen is salt, right? And until you can control salt and until you can figure it out, they don't really want you messing around with a bunch of other items. Well, the issue with school food, institutional food, is that salt is very much controlled. So you really have to get back and get into your mind, your mentality as a chef and a problem solver, and figure out how to work your way around really what was the spine of us learning how to cook and the backbone of us learning how to cook. So you have to get in there and be willing to move away from salt and fat, still provide a good meal to folks. And so I think if chefs can bring themselves to a common ground and understand the constraints in which folks are working in and cook within that realm, it really, some powerful things can happen.
Yeah, I love it. I know more and more chefs that are jumping into that space. The hours are usually great. The pay is better. And when they see the impact, the true impact, I mean, a lot of chefs, they want James Beard, the awards, that glitz and glam, but there's just a different reward system when you see a kid that might be the only meal, like really good meal that they get in a day. And when you provide a nourishing, just flavorful, packed, you're using your talents in a different way. When you see that kid's face light up, and you could tell, you just know that it changed them. And then they talk about it. I don't know. There's just something that fills my little meter up when you see that and kids just cheering, and they love that food. So if you're a chef out there, like don't give up on schools. There are ways. And if anything, I look at it as a challenge. Like you said, the sodium levels at 200 milligrams, it's difficult. However, that's why we use spices. That's why we use techniques to enhance those flavors. And I think chefs could really, you know, cook in a school for a day, and I think it'll change how your perspective is on the industry. So anyone that's out there or you're up and coming, you know, don't be afraid. Talk to schools or even management companies. Like, there are places and they need chefs, even though with as much equipment we're putting in those kitchens to help kind of dummy it down and foolproof it, at the end of the day, somebody still has to program those. Somebody still has to kind of know what's going on in order to execute at a high level. But man, I love what you're doing in the school space. When I read that, I had to dig deep a little bit deeper into it.
You know, I think you also touched on a really interesting thing. I think, you know, as you're going through your career, you never know what your fit's going to be, right? And I think a lot of us get in the career and yes, we want the James Beard Award. Yes, we want to be that Michelin star chef. But we find happiness and we find fulfillment in certain segments of food. And that might be barbecue. That might be being the guy who makes the best hamburger. It's not necessarily those Michelin stars, right? It's not necessarily those James Beard Awards. And it could be you go into industries like healthcare, and you go into these other segments of the industry, you can find a really fulfilling lifestyle in it. And I think if you look at, you know, what's happening with those Michelin stars, where they're now citing restaurants beyond fine dining, it shows that I think it's part of what we're seeing just industry-wide is a move towards appreciating food on every level.
Yeah, let me ask you a question. Since they are, like, I've known like taco trucks and taco stands that have like the one star for the food. Do you think it's ever possible that like a food institutional type food could ever achieve that? Do you think that's possible?
We have a couple hospitals, and the food that these guys are preparing in these hospitals are unbelievable. And I think, you know, that's also where we're seeing customers demanding more or better food in a process. And here's my answer. I mean, so for me, and I'm almost not going to say this because I'm worried it's going to ruin the place. For me, there is no better restaurant in the entire world than in Kailua, Hawaii, a little place called Times Cafe. And it makes a fried rice with Spam. And it is the ultimate breakfast with one fried egg on top of it. And I think if we're honest with ourselves and if we look back at the food that really we've loved and the great meals we've had, including a pizza at 2 in the morning, It's not necessarily always in the place of the linen. And if we're no longer deciding it on the base of the linen, why can't it be cooked in a kitchen in any place?
I love that answer. And Spam, don't sleep on Spam.
Don't sleep on Spam. No.
I grew up in a tiny town, and next to us, there was a bar, and they actually had an event every summer. It was called Spam Jam, and it was Spam cooked, grilled, fried, sauteed, you name it. It was cooked. So don't sleep on the Spam, people. I think any food ingredient, wouldn't you agree, could be transformed if you know what you're doing with it.
Yeah, absolutely. One more thing on Spam, since I mean, it's the closest my heart. You know, the state of Hawaii, we eat more Spam than anywhere else in the country. My wife hates it when I do this. We have someone that invites us over to something. They go, bring Hawaiian food. And I bring the Hawaiian version of PB&J, which is a Spam musubi. That is a block of rice with fried Spam on it wrapped in nori. And my wife hates that. Meanwhile, like, people, the worst bastardization of Hawaiian food is the Hawaiian pizza in so many different ways. I worked in a pizza parlor when I was about 16, and we were right on the edge of the Marine Corps base, and you get a guy call up and go, howdy, I'd like one of them Hawaiian pizzas. And you're like, let me guess, you're on the Marine Corps base. And you're like, yep. And the Spam is amazing. And I guess I ran off on a tantrum on there.
Oh, no, I love it. Yeah. Since you brought up, Hawaiian pizza, I don't know where the origin was. Like, I'm assuming it's not a real thing in Hawaii, that they put pineapple on pizza.
I can't think of anyone. I mean, if there's someone who grew up in Hawaii eating Hawaiian pizza, and I'm sure we're putting this out on the internet, so I'm going to get, if they're doing it, they're eating it in the closet when nobody's around in their house, so no one knows that they're doing it out there. Pineapple on a pizza, I can't do it. I can't get there.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's too much water, the sweetness of it. I've had it, but obviously I'm not a fan either. Going back to kind of the kitchens, and we talked about them being human centered and more than just being productive, but sustainable. How do we keep that alive? Like you said, it was the people in the kitchen. With as much technology as coming, with the equipment that's available, how do we still keep that human centeredness, or what kind of makes a kitchen? Around with all this tech?
I just don't know how you can remove it, right? I mean, it's the people at the end of the day are going to, no matter what level of automation we get to, are going to be key in that process. And I think that comes down to good management and good facilities. But I remember being in the heart of my restaurant days, and I think there was a good solid 6 months that I was just angry every morning I woke up, led some bad things in my life. And that was part of the attitude that you have to shift personally. But if you keep setting yourself up in a situation for failure, you're going to be in a bad mood. If every morning you go in and you built a mountain in front of you that is impossible or near impossible for you to climb, you got to figure out a way around it. And technology and equipment is almost consistently how you achieve that. And I think a resource that every chef and every kitchen manager should use is folks like yourself and your podcast. And I think factory reps that are out there are an amazing opportunity to understand what's out there. Go to a trade show and walk the floor and look at different equipment. Talk to people who are doing it different from you. I know we always speak about in the back of the house that we're constant learners. Embody that. Go and find someone beyond your circle and ask them, how would you attack this problem? How can you improve it? So to keep bringing up Hawaii, and I'm going to do it again. When you're sitting on the beach in Hawaii and you look out in the surf, you can almost guarantee, or you can almost guess, who's from Hawaii and who's not. And besides the example being a lifeguard fishing someone out, not from Hawaii, another way of doing it is people who didn't grow up around the ocean learn to swim in a pool. And when you learn to swim in a pool, you look down in the pool as you're swimming. You keep your head down. Well, that's a great idea if you're not worried about a surfboard coming in and cracking you on the head or a wave flipping you over. So if you look out in the ocean, you'll see the local boys always have their heads up and they're looking to see what's coming at them. I think when you're in a kitchen and you're working every single day, you have to put your head down and make it happen, which is great because you do. But the problem is you can't see what's coming down the road. And so there's nothing wrong with reaching out to folks that aren't in your discipline that maybe can see the next step coming down the line. And it can be a dramatic improvement in your life.
Man, that is a nugget right there. That's getting clipped. It's getting put out. I love that. You mentioned trade shows and like getting other perspectives. I think trade shows are phenomenal. I think that at the same time, there's becoming so many of them that they can kind of get washed of like, what one do you go to? You know, where, if you're going to invest back into yourself, which obviously to me is like the most important investment you could ever make in anything you do in your life. What, give me, you know, top 2-3 trade shows that you're like, if you really want to learn and expand yourself in this industry, you got to go to.
So I'm terrified to do this because this could cause some serious ramifications in my social circle. So I think your chef in the United States, NAFEM, which is every other year, that's North American Food Manufacturer Equipment. Did I get that right?
Food Equipment Manufacturer.
Yeah, there we go. I think that's a must. And that's every other year. NRA, National Restaurant Association, show in Chicago is a close second. Lifetime Trip is Host Milan. That's every other year. And
that's this year, isn't it?
It's this year. Yep, I'll be there this October. And you know, I mean, obviously there's a benefit. You're going to Italy and it's amazing and the people are fantastic, right? And you know, I think they have a little bit of a food scene out there too. clearly I'm
just,
joking.
Just a little.
For the record, I'm joking. But it's got an amazing scene, obviously. I think those are my three top shows. I think NAFEM's a must every other year. And the trick I think is when you go, look at as much stuff you can. You paid me down there. You're down there. You're looking around and talk to folks and don't eliminate what they're talking about until you get a chance to really absorb all of it.
Yeah. And keep those notes in your back pocket. I don't know how many times throughout my career in the given moment, I'm like, I'm never going to use this. This is irrelevant, and brush it off. And not even 6 months, a year later, I'm like, oh my God, I need that thing that I saw at a show where I talked to this person. That's exactly what I'm needing in this moment because something pops up, something is asked of you, and you just can't remember. So yeah, like to your point, take a business card, jot down a note, or in your phone, take a picture of the business card, whatever it is, the brand, just like 2-3 facts about what it is that caught your eye or what they're doing. And it'll save you in the long road because you'd be surprised at how many people will say, you know, I stopped by your booth 3 years ago, whatever it is. And they're like, I actually remember you. You worked it, blah, blah, blah. Like I think chefs in particular that have gone into the manufacturing world, I guess we have like kind of a steel trap brain and can kind of remember to a degree things that come up. But it is a great way to get exposed to the industry as a whole. And who knows, you may find, to your point, a fulfilling piece. Like again, at NAFEM, it's mostly equipment, but you never know where that road could lead to. Or if you're at NRA, it's everything, right? There's software, food, equipment. I mean, you name it, clothing, it's there and you may find it. So I like those three, and I am. I'm calling out the Italians right now. I'm trying. This guy's behind me. I'm trying to get out to host. I'm hoping. There's always a glimmer of hope, but if I can get out there.
So, like, here's an example, right? So, I mean, I think, like, when we go to the trade show floor, we look around. We're looking for, like, the fun stuff, right? We're looking for that really cool new wood grill or something like that, the stuff we're excited about, or great presentation pieces, or that beautiful pizza oven, that kind of thing. The other thing you might find is you might find a solution to something that was a problem that, you know, in the back of your mind you knew it was a problem, but until you see that piece, you don't connect it. So here's an example. Mm-hmm. I worked in an operation, we use a whole bunch of speed racks, right? And nothing, I don't know why I fixated on this, nothing would make me angrier than a speed rack that wasn't, you know, beautiful and clean. I don't know why it was the hill I was going to die on, but it was. So starting last year, I saw there's a new product. This is incredible multi-washer unit that cleans these speed racks. And, mm-hmm. you know, by no means that it was at the part of the culinary world that was I excited about, but it was a part that was a problem in my day that got solved. And the technology on this thing is amazing and its ability to clean this product. And I saw it recently in NRA, or sorry, a host. And just the solutions you can find on the floor are amazing.
Yeah. Small plug, multi-washer. Go check it out.
Very cool.
You'll be blown away if you just see the technology. It is like nothing else out there. All right. I want to wrap it up with some in the weeds fun type stuff questions. If you could design your dream kitchen from scratch, what three features are non-negotiable?
Dream kitchen? Probably. Yeah,
dream kitchen.
I mean, something that, did the dishes for me in an automated process would be absolutely key. For me, you know, dream kitchen, no roof, and a wood fire grill, and I'm a pretty happy guy.
Awesome.
Definitely not health code approved.
Well, yeah, of course. What's a piece of gear or tech you wish more chefs used?
I mean, I don't have a, horse in this race. I think blast chillers are the most underutilized design. I mean, my stuff's very specialized. It's in larger kitchens, that sort of thing. I think every kitchen should have a blast chiller. You know, it's the backbone to sanitation, but also, I mean, properly cooling a product might be the best way to preserve its quality. And, you know, the example I give is, you know, nothing's worse, nothing in the world's worse than overcooked broccoli.
Yeah, nobody wants a mushy, nasty
brown.
I don't know. Brown. Yeah, it turns.
Yeah.
I'd have to agree with you on that one. Yeah. I think I never see it in a lot of kitchens. And I know it was one of my biggest pain points through in education, getting stuff cooled down, ice wands, ice baths. It was just giant pain. And it was one of the biggest things, health inspector. And I mean, the log had to be spot on because we had to cook, to your point. You know, we were making batches of 30, 40 gallons of soup, and to cool that down in an appropriate manner. And, you know, people's shifts are changing. And so now you're like handing the guard out. We had a system, but if I had like a blast chiller, just be able to roll everything in and put a probe in and know that it's going to cool down in like 2 hours would have been game changing. So I have to agree with you on that one.
I'm embarrassed to admit this. Well, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'm embarrassed to admit this. When I was very young, I worked in a like a bar kind of thing. And we used to have a deal where if the ticket came over the typer, this is back in the day where you'd have a typer, not a screen, right? And it said, meat lover pizza vegan. That was the code that the health inspector was at the front door. And the first thing I'd do was sprint in the back to the temperature log and proceed to write, you know, 39, 39, 39, 39, 39, 39, 39, very fastly down the temperature log. You know, obviously that's not professional, but that's the reality of a lot of people's worlds.
Yeah. Unfortunately. All right. Last one. Let's see. Let's just go into, all right, you're in Colorado and you got to give a good food spot. You're outside of Denver, right?
I'm outside of Denver. Yes. Yeah.
Give me your top food spot you got to go to, because I got family out there. So I fly into Denver. So give me your top food spot to go hit up in the Denver area.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just, you know, as a Hawaii guy, I get homesick. There is a place down here called Taku Sushi. It's down in a little strip mall. They do a fantastic job. Absolutely love eating there. Unfortunately, as a guy who right now has a 4-month-old, I have not been out of the house for almost a year as far as going to restaurants. And I would say we just recently, three restaurants have received Michelin stars in Denver. Definitely worth checking out. One other one that comes to mind is a place called My Brother's Bar. It is very confusing telling people that because they think my brother has a bar, and he doesn't. And that's very disappointing to me. And it's, Jack Kerouac used to go and drink down there. They have, they bring out hamburgers on a little caddy with onions and all sorts of really great stuff. Another great like gem of Denver.
Awesome. Where do people go? They want to learn more about you. They want to learn more about the nonprofit. I can't remember the name. My apologies. And about Tux.
Yeah. So Tux Equipment. You know, I guess since they're paying my lifestyle, I should start off with them. That is TUCS, not TUX. So TuxEquipment.com. I am frequently on LinkedIn, and I love, if anyone ever reaches out to me, I love responding. And it's the best way to reach me, and that's Rob Maddock on LinkedIn. And then Nourish Colorado is nourishcolorado, I think, .org. You ambushed me on this one. I got to check it out. But I think it's Nourish Colorado.
Okay, we'll make sure it's correct in the show notes so people can get linked to that properly. Awesome. I love it. Any last words for those aspiring chefs out there? You've been a bucket full of knowledge. Any last parting words?
I mean, I think learn to do it the hard way, but keep your eyes open for what the best way to do it is.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much, Rob, for taking the time to come on. And we'll put links to everything we talked about into the show notes. So if you want to learn more, you can check that out. And until next time,
thank you.
HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.